Chinese air base, for example, in Vanuatu, could easily strike at Sydney or Canberra or potentially even Melbourne using cruise missile systems.
Why Australia wants to keep China away from the Pacific and...
Yeah, we know that we shouldn't eat hamburgers and drink milkshakes every day. We know we should have healthy food. But we haven't got that language around our digital lives yet.
Facing the facts about how toxic the digital world has become. Hello and welcome to The Wire, current affairs across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Annie Hastwell in Adelaide. Also today, can flies help us cut food waste?
We're really excited to use our native species and create new products like chocolate chip cricket cookies and even pastas that have never been seen before.
And the new report says our cultural scene is still way too white and Anglo. Stay with us for the next half hour on The Wire. Well, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has today arrived in the tiny Polynesian island country of Tuvalu. He's joining other regional leaders for the Pacific Islands Forum. Yesterday, he announced a $500 million climate change and oceans funding package for the Pacific. It's not new funding. It'll be redirected from Australia's existing aid programs for the region over 5 years, starting next year. Oxfam Australia's climate change advisor, Dr. Simon Bradshaw, is in Tuvalu now. Catherine Andrews asked him whether he thinks the $500 million pledge will go down well there.
Of course, that's going to be welcome on the one hand, because the challenges here have become so acute that any support with dealing with the impacts of climate change that can no longer be avoided, with climate-proofing infrastructure, with building resilient communities, that's essential. But it's only one part of Australia's responsibility, and arguably our first responsibility needs to be to stop contributing to the problem in the first place, to be taking action at home that aligns with our responsibilities under the Paris Agreement, that follows other countries around the world in moving away from coal towards a clean energy future. That's really what Pacific Island countries expect, and that's the consistent message that we've heard, that it's not about the cash. No amount of money can compensate for the risks that Australia is taking for the region's future by not taking action at home on climate change.
Can you give me an example of how climate change is visibly affecting Tuvalu locals' lives and their environment?
Of course, yes. I mean, you really can't be here in Tuvalu or Kiribati or the Marshall Islands, any other atoll country, without getting such a visceral and immediate sense of what's at stake. Where I'm standing now is about 2 metres above sea level, and that's just about as high as the land around here rises anywhere. It's as little as 20 metres wide, the atoll in some places. Here it's a bit wider, a couple of hundred metres, but you really get a sense of the vulnerability to sea level rise in particular. Also, coastal inundation from more powerful storms. And that, of course, leads to loss of fresh water supplies, to people losing their crops, losing their houses and homes even. But it's not just that loss of livelihoods and security that's involved, where people talk about having to actually leave Tuvalu because their land's inundated. That means leaving the very place where they have resided for millennia, the place of their ancestors, where all of their culture and identity is tied. So I think the impact is really quite profound over the coming decades. If we don't get our act in order, Australia and the other big emitters, and start taking climate change seriously. And certainly being here, you get a very real sense of that. And you have to hope that Scott Morrison, coming here and being exposed to these realities, might think twice about Australia's recklessness in the face of the climate crisis.
Do you think the locals will be trying to show such visible effects to Scott Morrison?
Look, absolutely. The very first thing Scott Morrison would have seen when he landed is there's a little display at the airport with some of the local skilled children sitting half submerged in water in front of a model of their island behind them and a sign there talking about the impact of climate change. So from the moment he lands, he will have been hit with that reality. But tomorrow he'll be going up to the far end of the atoll, I think, for the leaders' retreat, as they call it, on a piece of the island that's very, very narrow where you can see the lagoon on one side and the roaring Pacific Ocean on the other. That's the setting for when they'll be sitting down as leaders to talk these things out. And look, wherever you go here, you can see the evidence. You can see where the shoreline's been eaten back. You can see on a high tide where areas are getting flooded. And, of course, the moment you sit down with anyone here to talk about their lived experience, you're going to hear very directly and personally what's at stake.
Dr. Simon Bradshaw, Oxfam Australia's climate change advisor, speaking to The Wire's Catherine Andrews. So why is Australia suddenly making such an effort to get in the good books with our Pacific neighbours? Like so many things these days, it's all about China, as Dr. Malcolm Davis from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute told The Wire's Dominic Giannini.
Having Chinese influence and coercion in the Southwest Pacific would be devastating for our strategic interests, because with that comes the potential for Chinese access to ports and airfields as dual-use facilities that could eventually see PLA, Chinese military forces, forward deployed into the Southwest Pacific. Now, the eastern seaboard of Australia has not been threatened militarily since 1942. And you would see, if you had Chinese military bases in the Pacific, you would then see our eastern seaboard come under threat. And that would fundamentally change our strategic outlook for the worse. So that is one of the reasons why we are pushing the Pacific step up so strongly, to make sure that that never happens, that you will not have Chinese military forces able to threaten Australian cities on its eastern seaboard.
So just on that, if China's base in the South Pacific were to eventuate, wouldn't it be too isolated, essentially, to attack our eastern seaboard?
No. If you look at the operational range of Chinese military capabilities that the PLA Air Force and the PLA Navy are deploying, a Chinese air base, for example, in Vanuatu could easily strike at Sydney or Canberra or potentially even Melbourne using cruise missile systems. And secondly, if you flip that around, the strategic geography, it makes it much more difficult for the United States to deploy forces into the Western Pacific if the Chinese have got bases in the Southwest Pacific. It extends their anti-access and air denial perimeter further out from the second first island chain out towards the second island chain. Makes it possible for the Chinese to envelop Guam and also put pressure on both Taiwan and Japan. So, from a strategic geography perspective, if you're a planner in Beijing, it makes a lot of sense to extend your defensive perimeter out as far as possible, so you can not only threaten Australia if you wanted to, but also interdict US trade and US naval projection.
Dr. Malcolm Davis from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, speaking to The Wire's Dominic Giannini.
You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs from all over Australia.
Well, in an Australian first, Diversity Arts Australia have today unveiled a new report detailing a shocking lack of diversity in arts leadership positions. Oliver Brown reports.
Leaders in the arts industry have often denied accusations of unfair bias towards those with a white Anglo background. With today's report, Executive Director of Diversity Arts Australia, Lina Nachlus, believes we may now have proof that the lack of equal cultural representation starts at the top.
What the research has revealed, it looked at leadership of arts and screen and creative sector organisations. It looked at 200 organisations and almost 2,000 individuals. And it looked at people who were in leadership roles, so people on the board, in the executive roles and management roles. And it also looked at people who were judges on awards panels. And what it found was, in every art form area, there was an underrepresentation of people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds or migrant backgrounds as compared to the population, because there's 39% of people from non-Anglo migrant backgrounds in Australia.
The report recommended setting targets, creating new leadership pathways for culturally diverse artists, and advocated for a strong national arts policy.
We also wanted this report to be a kind of encouragement for organisations to change. And we know that there's a lot of good allies in, arts organisations and screen organisations across Australia. And I know that they will find this valuable in pushing for change and being able to kind of say, no, we've got this evidence here, and this is what we do need to introduce these programs. We do need to change the way that we act or the way that we are structured. So we're hoping that it's also an encouragement and an incentive.
Freelance writer Gemma Mahadio was one of several activists who attended this morning's launch to share their perspective. The daughter of Filipino and Indo-Guyanese migrants, Gemma experienced firsthand the problem of having a lack of diversity in high-up arts positions.
So I initially started my creative life off as an aspiring music academic and performer, and it's very, very elitist and exclusionary, and I was forced to discontinue my music studies as a result of mental health issues. It just wasn't a helpful environment. They weren't interested in helping me graduate, even though I only had, I think, a semester to go, which was really unfortunate. But in terms of writing and publishing, so now I write poetry and nonfiction, I feel like there's more support and there's more representation in terms of diversity.
Obviously, the fact that you were part of this launch of the report, it comes down to the fact that there's a lack of diversity in leadership positions. Is this something that you felt was very obvious while you were trying to get involved in the arts world?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't realise that there were different ways to get into the industry. I just assumed that I had to follow the model, which is unfortunately quite white, rather than looking at other options that are a bit more, I guess, grassroots-based.
Gemma would like to see more research in the future to cover other marginalised groups.
We do still have to look at not just people of colour or not just people that identify as cows, but we also have to look at being more inclusive towards Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. We need more discourse around disability. We also need to address sexism, homophobia, transphobia, because that's also things that we don't talk about in the arts as much as we could. And again, I feel like they don't have any representation leadership-wise. So it's going to be interesting. Ideally, I hope that we would start to follow the UK model and have quotas in place. And then eventually those quotas will mean that we'll start seeing diversity in leadership. I'm just a creative practitioner, and in a way, I'm kind of used to not seeing faces like mine in leadership positions. So ideally, I would love for this report to start making that happen.
Lena agrees on the need for a closer investigation into other demographics.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things that, you know, we're really aware of, that a lot of people who've come from non-Anglo migrant backgrounds are also people with disability, are also LGBTIQ. So we recognise that this is just one modest beginning and one piece of the puzzle. What we would like to do is work in partnership with organisations from those other areas, from the disability sector, First Nations sector, to kind of do more of this research and do it more deeply and also intersectionally as well.
That's Lena Nahlus, Executive Director of Diversity Arts Australia, finishing that report for The Wire's Oliver Brown. Across Australia, you're with The Wire. If you're listening in Mount Todd or Mataranka through the Karma Network, or maybe in Lightning Ridge on Opal FM 89.7, hello to you this afternoon. Twenty years ago, the arrival of the World Wide Web seemed to herald a utopian future with the world all connected at last. But in spite of having hundreds of friends on social media, being able to find out anything anywhere by a quick consultation with a smartphone, and never having to look at a map again, our society is divided, distracted and lonely as never before. Peter Lewis began his journalism career before the massive transformation that the internet has wrought. And watching his teenage children grow into a very different world, he decided to take a deep look at what he calls the worldwide wreck of tech and ask where we're heading. I spoke to Peter about his book Webtopia and asked him how the web has changed us all.
We've gone from being hunters and gatherers of knowledge to being people that are swimming in this sea of noise. And so the skills that they're purportedly learning is how to filter through the noise and make sense and still sort of build their knowledge based on, you know, the canons of Western civilization, or at least you'd hope that was the case.
That's the plan, but
yeah.
It hasn't all worked out that well, has it?
No, and, you know, I look at the way education has adopted technology, and I think education's been as guilty as anyone of just saying, get kids connected and they'll be smarter. And I really question that, and watching the way that my kids are learning, I think there's a whole lot of different pressures and barriers to enlightenment that I don't think the teaching profession saw coming either. So it's really interesting. I think we've reached this moment where there is a reckoning and a reconsideration of the impact of this amazing technology. And it's not to wind back the world to the way the world was. It's to say, hey, so how are we going to build something from here? Like, if all this had happened and the world was blooming, I'd say, let's keep going. But, you know, Trump's in the White House and populist dictators seem to be a new business model for politics across the world. We can't get our act together to act on climate change because we can't even agree on the most existential challenges we face as a world. Our jobs are disappearing through algorithms that have been generated from the recording of our own online activity that we willingly give, and we can't get off our bloody devices to think clearly. So, you know, the world's not going that great, and, you know, I feel that we're in a moment where there is a time for reflection and reckoning.
So the baddies, the big baddies, it's a bit like the Industrial Revolution, the giant coal companies and the ones that kept the children down the coal mines. The baddies are the Google, Facebook.
Baddies are just doing what business has always done. Why was it private businesses that created this infrastructure? Why wasn't it social cooperatives? Or and you know, the whole philosophy of the web in its early days was open source and radical collaboration, but then it got captured by capitalism. And to me, I think it's no coincidence that the web kind of came online just as the Cold War was ending. Capitalism triumphed, which morphed into libertarianism. And so this whole notion that the only role of government is to get out of the way and let freedom thrive has sort of driven the whole course of the web from open collaboration into what I'd call hyper-capitalism.
So we need to do something.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the kids down the coal mines earlier, and it's a really interesting analogy. So, you know, after the Industrial Revolution and this amazing change, you know, steam power into electricity power, it was creating huge winners, but it was also creating massive losers, and particularly kids. And out of that realisation came the factory acts, came the trade union movement, came mutuals and co-ops, and a sense that we need to harness this technology and make it work for us. I'm hopeful that if we all start being more mindful of the way that this technology is changing our lives, we can do similar things now. And it's kind of up to us because the technology won't do it for us.
Are you optimistic about the future?
If I wasn't, I wouldn't be able to get up and keep going. And I think history has shown with technological change that we do adapt. And there are some fantastic people trying to get this thing going globally. We're about to hit the next wave, which is AI. And I think it's incumbent on us to think through what that actually means, what it means to whether we're going to have jobs and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, what it means to the services that are coming back at us and what's going to do to our human agency. So let's start talking about it, because if we're mindful of it, at least we can channel it in some way.
You talk about data as being like the oil of the 21st century and it's being mined for all it's worth.
Yeah.
This idea that you could reclaim your own data, how hard would that be to do though?
Well,
we don't know where it is now, do we?
We're handing it over every single day. So, and whenever you click one of those block boxes to get access, or say you can use my cookies, or when you rig your house up with the next smart personal assistant who's, you're also ticking a box that they can record everything you do. Why can't this technology deliver us a service without asking for all the other stuff at the end? And then if somebody comes along that does that and says, yeah, we just want to give you what the technology can offer, we don't want the extras, will we as consumers say, yeah, that's a much better way to go forward? What the corporates are doing, the government's doing as well, it is following us around and knowing what we do. And that hasn't been part of Western tradition, where there has been a sense that an individual's got certain rights to live their own life. You know, one of the other insights when I was thinking through this book was that this idea that there's a World Wide Web is very 1990. We've now got a whole bunch of different webs. We've got the Chinese surveillance web. We've got the Russian, you know, mafia net. We've got the hyper-capitalist American net. We're building a European net that's got, well, they're building a European net that's got some more defined rights for citizens. So what should the Australian web look like? And can we, as we were post-industrial revolution, become a beacon to the rest of the world by having a set of laws and civic institutions that reflect a modern world, but also place respect on the notions of, you know, equality and, you know, the old French, like equality, fraternity and liberty?
Journalist and author Peter Lewis. His book Webtopia is published by New South Books. Well, when was the last time you chucked half your dinner in the bin? It probably wasn't too long ago and you probably didn't think twice about it. But on a worldwide scale, food waste is a major problem and it's severely impacting our climate. Now scientists are developing new creepy crawly ways to combat the issue. The Wire's Kale Matthews with this report. Have a big dinner, have a light snack. If you don't
like it, you can't send it back. Just eat it. Last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report entitled Climate Change and Land. And it turns out most of the food we make, we are not, in fact, eating it. The report showed that we waste one-third of all of the food that is produced worldwide. And that is a massive waste of resources. The more wasteful we are with our land, the more we impact climate change. Annette Cowie, Principal Research Scientist in the New South Wales Department of Primary Industry and one of the authors on the report, says that the impact food waste has on climate change goes largely unnoticed.
Most Australians haven't probably thought about it as a climate issue, but if you think about the emissions associated with growing and producing and transporting and storing and taking home and cooking and then putting it in your fridge and then not using it and throwing it away, that adds up to quite a lot of emissions through the whole food supply chain associated with food waste.
But how does throwing out my unwanted veggies contribute to greenhouse gases?
Food waste, if it goes to landfill, it decomposes and it produces methane, which is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, so that's a problem as well.
So if food waste is such a large contributor to climate change, what are we currently doing to combat the issue?
There are a lot of activities at various different levels, at the council level, at community group level. There are projects to collect and redistribute food that's not required or hasn't been sold, and that's very beneficial. The New South Wales government is looking into ways that we can use food waste more usefully. So, for example, in biogas plants, so that we can generate energy from that decomposing food waste.
But Dr. Brian Lassard, entomologist at the CSIRO, Australian National Insect Collection, has another solution, and it involves harnessing the power of the humble fly.
The black soldier fly is an amazing species of insect that can eat any sort of food waste. They can turn it into a really rich source of protein. Each soldier fly is between 30 or 45% crude protein. So it's a great way of recycling nutrients from food waste into a protein meal that we can then feed to farmed fish or poultry.
And this means we could have flies flying their way around the country.
GoTerra are changing the game by creating modular units that sends the insects to the side of the food waste. So if you have a grape harvest and you want to get rid of the grape bark, you could send a modular bin there to treat the food waste on site.
But flies may not just gobble up our leftovers. They could also become our main meal.
So the United Nations estimate that global edible insects are worth $1.5 billion in the next 4 years. And there's a real opportunity for Australia to jump on board this trend. Australia is lucky because it has a lot of native species that have been eaten by Aboriginal communities for thousands of years. So we're looking to work with the Indigenous communities of those areas and create new collaborations with them to sustainably farm these iconic species and create new exciting food products for us.
And so which insects are going to be the tastiest treats?
We could really explore using witchetty grubs, bogon moths, and even the green tree ants, which are quite zesty because their abdomens taste like citrus. And we're really excited to use our native species and create new products like chocolate chip cricket cookies and even pastas that have never been seen before. So we're really excited about creating new sustainable food using our Aussie insects.
But a cricket smoothie or a witchetty grub parmigiana is not going to be everyone's cup of tea. So how do we ease the general public into consuming these critters?
If you're not comfortable eating a full cricket, what we can do is turn it into a protein powder that you can then bake with. So we've actually baked Anzac biscuits and even a chocolate cake using cricket powder, and you wouldn't even know that there's insect in there.
And so, should I be adding insects to my shopping list in the near future?
That's what we'd love to see, is in 20 years or so that these edible insect products are on the shelves at huge supermarkets, because insects are way more sustainable at creating this amount of protein we need in our diet. They're a choir of the a fraction of the land and water as traditional protein. So it's a really exciting new opportunity, and we can't wait to roll our sleeves up and get into it.
Dr. Brian Lessard, entomologist at the CSIRO, ending that report from The Wire's Cale Matthews. That's it for today. The Wire is a co-production between 2SER in Sydney, 4EB in Brisbane and Radio Adelaide. You can hear us again same time tomorrow on your local station. Check out our website. It's thewire.org.au. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Annie Hastwell. Thanks for your company.